There are lots of whistleblower organizations out there, especially in the United States, Western Europe, and Australia. But many of them are very parochial. They focus on narrow subjects or issues rather than focusing on the mental well-being of the whistleblower. Becoming a whistleblower is a decision not to be taken lightly, I promise you that. It often results in almost immediate social and professional ostracism and isolation. So how does a whistleblower deal with that? Well, he or she associates with the right organization. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. We've already told you the personal story of Pentagon whistleblower Jackie Garrick. Jackie grew up like many Americans who came from immigrant families, intensely patriotic and wanting to give something back to the country that had given them so much. In the 1980s, she did an internship at the Veterans Administration Medical Center in New York and developed an interest in post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, in veterans who had returned from service in Vietnam. In 1992, she joined the Army as a captain and as a social worker, following the adage, "If you want to work with veterans, be one." After leaving the military, she worked as the deputy director of healthcare at the American Legion, and then went on to a position on the Veterans Disability Benefits Commission in the Department of Veterans Affairs. And after a few years on Capitol Hill, the Obama administration asked her to organize the Defense Suicide Prevention Office, which oversaw disability policies impacting wounded warriors, mental health care accessibility, suicide prevention, and diversity and inclusion. Jackie survived a period of great turmoil at the Pentagon, serving under 10 undersecretaries and 12 supervisors in only 8 years. In 2014, Jackie began working for a politically appointed supervisor who seemed to be hostile to her after she made legally protected disclosures regarding possible conflicts of interest and possible contract fraud. She was moved to another chain of command and soon after found that her performance ratings were being lowered and job openings were being closed to her. She filed whistleblower complaints with both the Office of the Special Counsel and with the Defense Department's Office of the Inspector General. For purely bureaucratic reasons, Jackie never received any satisfaction from her whistleblowing. And indeed, in the end, she lost her job and was deemed ineligible for federal retirement. It was only after a Freedom of Information Act request and an appeal beyond the Office of Personnel Management that she was finally able to retire. And once she did, she created the group Whistleblowers of America, where she provides peer support for other whistleblowers who have suffered retaliation after having identified harm to individuals or to the public. That's what we want to tell you about today. Jackie, thanks for joining us. We're so glad to have you back.
Thank you for having me back. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to speak to you twice.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, believe me. Jackie, the last time we had you on the show, we talked about your own whistleblowing, but we didn't have time to get into what you've done since then. And actually, the work you've done has been very important. You created Whistleblowers of America, which is one of the leading whistleblower advocacy groups in the country. Tell us about why you did that. There were certainly other whistleblower groups already in existence. What were they missing that you wanted to accomplish?
Sure. So I think the idea for Whistleblowers of America was born out of this conversation that I had with a complete stranger. We were connecting through LinkedIn and got on a phone call, and she endorsed having a gun and was actively thinking about suicide. And it just reminded me of all the conversations I had ever had with combat vets. And I thought, we cannot go through this alone. One of the things I saw that worked with veterans so well was to bring a peer support approach and to have people connect. So that's when I felt like we needed to create Whistleblowers of America to really address these psychosocial, mental health, sense of safety issues. We needed to make people feel more resilient and to really combat the trauma piece. You notice I'm in a hotel, I'm in San Diego this week for the Institute on Violence, Abuse, and Trauma, and we just presented to probably 100 or so clinical staff that comes out of the federal government, the state, the private sector, this issue resonates with people. They understand that workplace trauma, workplace bullying means something, and that we have to start addressing these issues.
Amen to that. To me, one of the most important things that you or anybody else could do is to provide this peer support to whistleblowers. I can't stress how stress enough, really, how important this is, not just for me as a whistleblower, but for many other whistleblowers that I'm in touch with. A whistleblower once asked me what I thought I needed the most when I blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program. I said, money, a press spokesman, and a psychiatrist. And I was only half joking. Every whistleblower feels isolated after going public, and he or she needs someone to talk to, even if it's just to vent. So tell us about that and about the peer-to-peer mentoring program.
Yeah, so I think you're 100% spot on with that observation. It's the and it's easy to find the attorneys because they're, you know, there's lots of organizations, bar associations, there's ways to look up the attorneys. But most whistleblowers don't even fully understand that what's happening to them is trauma. Mm-hmm. As a mental health community, we're, I think, in the beginning of understanding PTSD and whistleblower retaliation, quite the way we were in the 1980s when PTSD was a new diagnosis, mm-hmm. and Vietnam vets were, you know, listed as having more neurosis or malingering and lazy. We had all these negative stereotypes associated with them in that generation. And it wasn't until other eras of veterans, other types of survivors, accident victims, crime victims, disaster victims were starting to come forward and saying, hey, wait, this is me too. I have these symptoms too. And I think we're going to see the same thing with whistleblowers, and we're going to start to see retaliation, or at least I'm hoping we'll see retaliation and the mental health impact that it has without having it also be a weaponized diagnosis that then gets used against them. So I think we see this catch-22. We know we need more mental health, and yet because of the legal system and the ramifications that come with taking cases to court mm-hmm. for damages, for pain and suffering, we're still at a place where we're arguing that, just like the VA argued PTSD and combat trauma mm-hmm. with Vietnam vets for decades, until, you know, we sort of got that presumption that if you were in a combat zone, you were exposed to trauma. If you're in a hostile work environment, you were exposed to trauma. And we have to have a trauma-informed perspective.
I think that's absolutely right. Whistleblowers of America has a wonderful website, www.whistleblowersofamerica.org. Is that right?
Org.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I encourage all of our viewers to go and take a look at it. It is so straightforward and plain spoken that it makes this complicated issue of whistleblowing actually easy to get through. Many whistleblowers fear becoming known as a rat or a snitch. This is something you address on the website. Somebody who tells on others. Years ago, I helped the Greek government write a new whistleblower protection law. This was in 2015. It was eventually passed, and it became the basis for the European Union's whistleblower protection law. But a great deal of the work was getting past the idea that whistleblowing was snitching. Tell us how you've dealt with that.
Yeah, so I think what you're talking about on our website is we've written letters to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary and asked them to change the definition. Because, and they told us that the reason Microsoft, because we wrote to Microsoft first, and they told us that the reason that when you type the word whistleblower and you hit synonym, you get rat, snitch, tattletale, stool pigeon, all those negative things. So the description is very positive, you know, preventing wrongdoing, addressing corruption. It's all very positive things. And then you come to the synonyms and, you know, the rails come off. And so we started this campaign by writing to Microsoft, who came back and told us, we just pull it from Merriam-Webster. So we've written to Merriam-Webster and they said, well, it's all about common language use. So they've encouraged us to address common language use issues, and that when people are defining whistleblowers, that they're using the words, heroes of integrity, truth teller, ethicist, protector, first relator, discloser. We've gotten lamplighter, bell ringer. Mm-hmm. There are so many other more positive words to describe what whistleblowers are actually doing than the negative ones. And, you know, if we don't reduce the stigma, then we don't make these employees feel safe in the workplace. And mm-hmm. that's really what a lot of this is about, is psychological safety. And if veteran had a bad connotation, right, nobody would want to claim to be a veteran. We just have to get past the negative connotation of the word and make people proud to be a whistleblower and make organizations to be proud to have them. And then maybe we can get away from weaponizing diagnoses.
Jackie, talk a little bit about founding the group, about pulling together resources and the work that you've done. What kinds of whistleblowers have reached out to you for help? Is it specific to the military or to government, or do you accept all variety of whistleblowers?
Yeah, so when we did our articles of incorporation, an attorney asked me, so what's our scope? And I said, well, I don't know. I want to help everybody. I naively had this vision of it being like a lean-in circle. You know, 12 of us were going to get together, have some coffee, and talk about our cases. Well, we're closing in on almost 1,000 people who have contacted us in our 5 years, and they are in 17 countries.
Wow.
And that just keeps reaffirming to me that this is a trauma-based response to these toxic tactics, just like the toxicity of a combat zone, mm-hmm. just like any crime victim. We are seeing the same kind of effects universally. And it doesn't matter what uniform, a combat vet wore. You know, they could serve in Greece, in the US, in the UK, Holland, Finland, France, you pick a country, they all can have PTSD no matter the structure of the military because of the exposure. And so that's where I believe that these hostile work environments, there's almost like a presumption that we need for that because of the universal nature of when you attack someone, when you defame them, when you bully them, haze them, when you marginalize them, gaslight them. Those are those tactics that we look at very specifically and have outlined. I think I've mentioned we did a Dr. Martina Buck and I did a book on the psychosocial impacts of whistleblower retaliation. It was so that we could set up a whistleblower retaliation checklist, because, you know, we like checklists in this world. We have to have a way of documenting and measuring. And if we can't hold you accountable, then this is not going to end. And the way to hold people accountable is to make them pay for it. And if you harm someone, you know, I lose my arm in a wood chipper, we know how to accommodate me or compensate me mm-hmm. in a disability construct. We need the same thing for mental health and for whistleblower retaliation.
You make a very important point on the website that I'd like to reiterate here, and that is that whistleblower retaliation is bullying. Now, we're finally getting mm-hmm. smart all around the world about bullying and what bullying leads to. It can lead to terrible things, not just social ostracism, but things like suicide or alcoholism or drug abuse, you know, self-medication to try to get through the bullying. We have to keep repeating over and over that retaliation against whistleblowers is a form of bullying. And another thing that we need to keep repeating over and over again is the fact that there is a legal definition of whistleblowing, and that is bringing to light evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. That's not snitching or ratting or being a tattletale. It's in the public service. So it's up to us. Yeah. I agree with you completely. It's up to us to make sure that the general public, who maybe otherwise wouldn't give much thought to an issue like this, gets our side of the story. Because this is going to sound arrogant, but we're right and they're wrong. And we have to make sure that they understand that.
Right. And even when we are wrong, we don't deserve to be harmed.
Yeah, I agree
with
you.
Everyone deserves a safe place to work.
Absolutely correct. We're going to cut to a short break, so please stay with us. When we get back, we'll ask Jackie Garrick about the role of Whistleblowers of America in the constellation of whistleblower groups and about an important upcoming event. We'll be right back.
The discovery of the New World at the end of the 15th century, there appeared Atlantic slave trade. The slave traders from European countries started building forts on the western coast of the African continent to transport the African inhabitants to America to be forced into hard labor. Until the middle of the 17th century, Portugal had played the main role in this atrocious business. Then Great Britain, France, and the Netherlands took the leadership. For the span of 400 years of legal and illegal slave trade, about 17 million people were forcefully shipped across the Atlantic, not including those who died on the way due to unbearable living conditions. Modern historians estimate that for each slave shipped to America, there were five who died while captured, during transportation, and cruel obliteration of rebellion. This ruthless people trade practiced by the leading European countries took away tens of millions of African lives. The Organization of United Nations classifies the transatlantic slave trade as one of the gravest human rights abuses in the history of humanity. This is the biggest act of deportation of people ever seen by mankind.
In 1950, the USSR was returning to peaceful life, but the newspapers didn't report ongoing massacres in the Ukrainian SSR. According to intelligence, Ukrainian nationalists and the Ukrainian insurgent army, led by Roman Shugievich, perpetrated these atrocities.
Shugievich уже дошел до того, что он в обращениях писал, что убивайте, убивайте, убивайте. То есть призывал просто убивать. И миллионы.
Pavel Sudoplatov was the head of the NKVD sabotage department at the time. He was tasked with stopping the atrocities in Ukraine for a good reason. General Sudoplatov was very familiar with the situation. He'd had experience fighting the nationalists before the war.
At that time, I was already an experienced man. Experienced in the counter-intelligence work, especially in Ukraine.
The task was tremendously difficult, but Sudoplatov was determined to complete it. He had personal accounts to settle with the Ukrainian nationalists.
Museums are important for preserving our history so that it isn't lost to future generations. But our physical museum spaces themselves a relic of the past. This is one of the best museums in the world, the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. Mikhail Petrovsky is the director here, and I bet he has some answers.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Jackie Garrick, a Pentagon whistleblower and the founder of Whistleblowers of America. Jackie, good to have you with us.
Good to be back.
Jackie, Whistleblowers of America is hosting an event here in Washington, D.C. during the first week of September. Tell us about that event and about what the organization is doing for it.
Yeah, so we started the Workplace Promise Institute into our third year. It was the beginning of the pandemic. So we began by having our first conference virtually. Because we do what we call a whistleblower protection advocate certification, and we came up with this idea that a minimum of 10 hours of training was what somebody should have so that they understood what we did and our network and the peer support and the skills. We first launched that again 3 years ago, and now this year we're going to be doing our event live and live streaming from Washington, D.C. at at 614th Street in downtown, right by Metro Center. And the goal is to meet the requirements for the hours for the training, as well as provide people the opportunity to connect. We have a host of attorneys joining us. We have an international panel, so people are logging in from all over the world. We are going to be talking to journalists like yourself and some publishers, some book writers, and talking to some health staffers so that we can talk about the different things that whistleblowers need to know and how we can help mentor and support each other through the process. On the first day, we do what we call the Giraffe Awards. We started those because whistleblowers stand tall and stick their necks out. Everywhere I go, I find a giraffe, and I just found this little guy here in San Diego. So I'm taking him home with me because we need to be mindful that we have to embrace this idea that this is who we are and this is what we've done. And we need to recognize each other. We're also going to do a Rose Garden March to the White House from our conference location, because Senator Grassley has asked every president since Ronald Reagan to host a whistleblower in the Rose Garden, and none ever has. Wow. So we are decided that, you know what, we don't need to wait for any president. We've got our own roses. They're plastic, but we have our own roses, and we're going to take them with us, and we're going to stand outside the White House, and we're going to host our own ceremony. We have children joining us this year of the whistleblowers, because we've spent some time this year focusing on whistleblowing as a family issue. Mm-hmm. As you probably know, especially when there are minor children in the house, they're home when the home is raided. Mm-hmm. They're watching their parents struggle. They're learning how to be afraid. They're being told, don't answer the phone, don't answer the door, don't go out. We always need to know where each other is. So we see this intergenerational transmission of trauma. They might not fully understand what they're experiencing, but you know, Yael Danieli, who's the founder of the Intergenerational Legacy of Trauma Project in New York, that's probably not the full title, but we had her on one of our roundtables, and we talked about children who are survivors because they lived through the experience, and then children who grow up with parents who have been traumatized. They don't understand the trauma, but they understand or are taught the hypervigilance and the responses that trauma survivors go through. So we're incorporating them this year, and they're actually making these watercolor paper roses that we're gonna take up to Senator Grassley, and that we're gonna take to the White House with us. Very exciting.
That is
exciting. To have them join us this year.
That's right.
To do these kinds of projects and bring community together is really important.
It is indeed. You know, for a second, I thought maybe I was missing out on something, because no president has ever invited me to the White House to celebrate Whistleblower Protection Day. So I guess I'm not.
March with us.
That's right. Does Whistleblowers of America?
We're going to do it ourselves.
That's right. We'll just do it ourselves. Does Whistleblowers of America partner with other organizations? I'm thinking about, for example, the National Whistleblower Center, which is here in Washington, the Government Accountability Project, and the like. I'm also interested in hearing about your areas of real expertise and specialties. What does Whistleblowers of America do best, in your estimation?
So we believe you. I think that's what we do best.
Yeah.
You don't need to prove anything to us. There's love and acceptance for you as a whistleblower. We're going to try to help you as best we can. We are a very small nonprofit, so we're all volunteers. There's no paid staff. So we do our best to connect and to listen and to share and give advice and sometimes just to offer that moral support. We have worked with the other groups, nonprofits, law firms. I take help and assistance from anybody who's offering it. The March to the White House, GAP, and the Food Integrity Campaign Project that did the virtual Rose Garden event, I think on LinkedIn and on social media platforms, they're helping us this year with getting the word out about the March to the White House. And We have attended events that the National Whistleblower Center has put on, the National Whistleblower Summit and Film Festival, as well as some international partners. We've worked a lot with Whistleblowers UK in the UK, Whistleblower House in South Africa, Whistleblowing Canada, Blueprint for Free Speech. You've mentioned Greece. Mm-hmm. We've worked with the chapter there. So we've got a large group of people coming for the Global Imperative Panel that are working in several different countries. I wish we can have all 17 on one panel, but obviously we can't do that. And but we've got some really great speakers coming in. And again, I have found there's just this international groups, and we're really trying to build coalition, because I think, you know, we're stronger together.
Yes.
We need an army. We need to raise our own army, and we can't splinter and fight, because we need each other to carry home a consistent message.
100% right. I'm curious also about whether private sector whistleblowers reach out to you. Here in Washington, it's so easy to focus on government and government whistleblowers, and especially military and national security whistleblowers. But what about people who work in private industry? Do they approach you?
Yeah, we've had every type of story imaginable at this point. Lots of government, lots of Department of Veterans Affairs employees. They're probably 40% actually of the people who reach out to us. We get a lot of law enforcement, but we've had some, you know, money laundering, banking. Again, part of the international is corporate whistleblowers from all over the world reach out to us because they're just looking for that level of support. Discrimination cases, racism, disability discrimination. If you've made a disclosure of any kind of nature, as long as you do it as an employee, that's kind of the limit of our scope. Mm-hmm. We will do our best to help you, match you with somebody who's had a similar story to yours, find the resources that you maybe need, teach you how to find an attorney, teach you how to find a therapist, work with you if you're really wanting to talk to a journalist. I think you've interviewed a couple of people we've sent your way.
Yes, indeed. Jackie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me back, and I look forward to seeing you at the Workplace Promise Institute, September 7th and 8th.
We're gonna have a good time. September 7th and 8th, right here in Washington, D.C., 600 14th Street Northwest. I wanna thank our viewers also for joining us. On the Whistleblowers of America website, there's a quote by President John F. Kennedy that so perfectly encapsulates the mind of the whistleblower that I have to convey it to you. It's this, quote, "Without belittling the courage with which men have died, we should not forget those acts of courage with which men have lived. The courage of life is often a less dramatic spectacle than the courage of a final moment. But it is no less a magnificent mixture of triumph and tragedy. A man does what he must, in spite of personal consequences, in spite of obstacles and dangers and pressures. And that is the basis of all human morality. In whatever arena of life one may meet the challenge of courage, whatever may be the sacrifices he faces if he follows his conscience, the loss of his friends, his fortune, his contentment, even the esteem of his fellow men, each man must decide for himself the course that he will follow. The stories of past courage can define that ingredient. They can teach, they can offer hope, they can provide inspiration, but they cannot supply courage itself. For this, each man must look into his own soul." Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou, and we will see you next time.